Today in Studio 360, three up-and-coming comedians walk into a bar. These days, chances are all three are producing a podcast.
I think a podcast is the ultimate social networking for a comedian right now, as we speak, and it's even getting bigger.
Podcasts cut out the middlemen, too. How giving away stuff for free is helping comedians make more money. And G is for Grafton. Sue Grafton, the mystery writer who's been working on her alphabet series for 30 years. Still to go, W, X, Y, and Z. After that?
After that, I will be close to 80 years old, and I personally think I should be allowed to take a long nap and then party.
That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, math. Don't worry, we're not going to ask you to do calculus problems. Instead, we'll go to a new museum devoted to making math amazing.
It's actually like a jumbotron in the ground, and your feet are touching the touchscreen. What we're showing here is the shortest path to connect all of us that are standing on the square right now.
I wonder what's going to happen when I get on all fours.
Doing the crab walk at the new math museum later this hour. But first, on TV this week, you can watch a cabinet nominee on Capitol Hill fighting iffy, undermining allegations that he is insufficiently pro-Israel. Or, in a parallel TV universe starting this week, you can watch a make-believe cabinet nominee fighting iffy, undermining allegations that he's insufficiently pro-Israel. The fictional spectacle is only available via Netflix as part of their first big play to be entertainment producers as well as distributors. It's a new Washington politics dramatic series called House of Cards, starring Kevin Spacey.
Power is a lot like real estate. It's all about location, location, location. The closer you are to the source, the higher your property value. Centuries from now, when people watch this footage, who will they see smiling just at the edge of the frame?
Spacey plays the House Majority Whip, our deeply cynical guide to power in Washington right now. One of the show's creators is Bo Willimon, who wrote the play Farragut North, which became the Ryan Gosling, George Clooney movie Ides of March. And he joins me now. Bo, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
One of the interesting things about this series, of which I've seen two episodes, is you have this Kevin Spacey character, this main character, talking to the camera a lot. Was that an idea from the get-go?
The series is based on a miniseries that aired in the UK in 1990 on BBC called House of Cards, starring Ian Richardson. And in that miniseries, which was a grand total of 12 episodes, Ian Richards' character spoke to the camera. And from the very beginning, it was one of the things that we wanted to steal and find a way to make our own. You put that in the hands of Kevin Spacey, and it amplifies the drama and gives the audience access to his schemes that makes them complicit and, in a way, accomplices. So it's really delicious.
So Kevin Spacey, he's Southern, we hear, in that accent?
Yeah, the character is from South Carolina. I decided to make him from South Carolina because there's a catchphrase in the BBC version that's very famous in the UK where Francis says, "You very well might think that I couldn't possibly comment," which works great in an aristocratic British accent. I wanted to keep it, at least in a couple instances, as an homage, but Americans don't talk that way. And then I thought, well, my dad's from South Carolina. I'm familiar with the accent. If you use an upcountry South Carolina
accent, the kind of courtly.
Yeah, you very well might think that I couldn't possibly comment.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it works.
Part of the deal, a big part of the deal with Netflix, is that your whole first season come all at once, 13 hours all at once starting next weekend. How did that affect the writing?
I feel like on a lot of TV shows, even the best among them, you were put in a position where you have to fight for your survival in the ratings game, particularly in the first half of season one. So you find unfortunate artificial cliffhangers at times that their only purpose is to make people remember the show a week later and come back. Since we're delivering all 13 at once, there wasn't the need to create those artificial cliffhangers. We could really invest our time in character development and sophisticated storytelling. And we hope that's what makes people want to click on to the next episode, as opposed to trying to pull the wool over their eyes with jacked up suspense.
This is a big, new, expensive, high-profile play for Netflix. David Fincher and you and Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright and all this big deal. The fact that it's this new attempt to disrupt the status quo of entertainment, does that add pressure to your job?
Well, we can't walk around each day in the writer's room thinking, you know, all the pressure is on us to determine whether this is a viable model for the future. In a way, we're in the right place at the right time. I think this shift was going to happen regardless. You have people binge watching two or three seasons of a show over the course of a weekend, and that was just never possible before. We were conditioned into thinking TV had to happen once a week at a certain hour. We definitely seized the opportunity, and Netflix put a lot of faith in our show to be the first to do this. But we certainly won't be the last, and I think it'll become the norm.
Before you became a chronicler of politics, you worked briefly for a while in politics in Howard Dean's campaign in 2003-04, I guess.
I worked on a number of campaigns. My first campaign actually was Chuck Schumer's campaign in 98 when I was still in college.
And campaigns and campaigning is one thing, one highly theatrical thing that makes for good drama. Governing, I think people often don't realize how different a thing that is. Have you had to go elsewhere and talk to other people or think about it differently to figure out how to make a 13, 26-part series about governing?
Well, from my work in the various campaigns I worked on, I got to know a lot of people who work in Washington who went on to become superstars in the political operative world. So I'm constantly calling them and talking to them, running story past them, asking their advice on things. I mean, a campaign is very different from governing, but what's similar is that all politics, to a certain degree, is theater. You're always trying to sell something, either to the public or to other politicians who you need to get on board. So it's a constant act of salesmanship and, to a certain degree, subterfuge. You know, all great theater is a lie at the end of the day, but it's a lie that becomes a truth. And there's a certain parallel to that in the political world. There's a saying that D.C. is just Hollywood for ugly people. And I think that there's some truth to that as well.
And as you wrote the first 13 and as you're now presumably writing the second 13, how do you play with the reality that's going on in 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014 of trying to be more like, less like, predict, get out of the way of real life or get in the way of real life?
The nature of writing a television show is that you're writing it many months before it'll be shot, and then that's happening many months before it'll actually make its way to the public. So it's a fool's errand to try to rip things from the headlines. You do find in some occasions that life imitates art.
Well, like this Chuck Hagel thing that I mentioned in the introduction.
Yeah, sure, exactly. But, you know, we've also seen plenty of nomination battles in the past. So you're drawing from history as much as you're drawing from the present, as much as you're trying to anticipate the future. Politics is politics. A lot of the same universal truths about it go back to one caveman hitting another caveman over the head with a rock.
Bo Willimon, good luck. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All 13 episodes of the first season of House of Cards will be available on Netflix starting Friday. Last week, I asked you a question. Are we the only intelligent beings in the universe? We challenged you to provide an answer not in writing, but an illustration, a piece of art, as technical or as whimsical as you'd like. A listener named Pedra sent in a multidimensional portrait of inner and outer space. Reinhard sent us old-fashioned pencil drawings of alien creatures that might be out there somewhere. Our contest was inspired by The Where, the Why, and the How, a new book that illustrates complicated and unresolved science. You can see pictures from the book in a slideshow at studio360.org. And we do want to see your take on the question. Are we alone in the universe? Submit your illustration at studio360.org before midnight on February 3rd. We'll announce the winner next month. Still ahead this hour of Studio 360, the author Sue Grafton, who, unlike most novelists, started in Hollywood and, despite success, turned to book writing to escape it.
I am just not a team player. I do not like to write by committee, and I don't like help. So in Hollywood, if you're not interested in collaboration, you just have no business being there.
Sue Grafton, hating on show business, ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. My dad, unlike most dads, was a great reader of fiction, most voraciously of crime, mystery, detective novels. His one significant home improvement my whole life was adding about 60 feet of bookshelves devoted to his detective novels. As a kid, I remember noticing a surprising share of those authors were women. Agatha Christie, P.D. James, Martha Grimes, and then, in the last decade of his life, Sue Grafton. 30 years ago, she published A is for Alibi, then B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse, all starring a tomboyish 30-something private detective named Kinsey Millhone. And starting around G is for Gumshoe, they all became huge bestsellers, including her latest, V is for Vengeance. But while her millions of readers await W is for whatever, Sue Grafton has just published a collection of short stories called Kinsey and Me. And she is here with me now. Sue Grafton, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being with you.
So there are tens of millions of copies of all of your books about Kinsey Millhone out in the world. But for listeners who aren't yet acquainted, tell us a little bit about her.
Well, when I began this series in 1982, she was 32 years old. She has been married and divorced twice. She owns one dress. She cuts her hair with a pair of nail scissors, cusses like a soldier, very down to earth, and has a very wicked eye when it comes to observing human nature.
So she's kind of an every woman, except that she runs several miles every day and solves crimes.
She jogs. It isn't running. Even she would admit that. But she eats a lot of junk food, which I can no longer do myself.
When the first one came out in the early 80s, it was kind of a big deal because your detective was this woman, this young, tough, modern woman. Did you have a sense as you embarked on this that the time was ripe and maybe overripe for such a detective in fiction?
No, I can't claim any prescience. I can't claim I was even aware. I just didn't realize there were no female private investigators. I was raised reading male hard-boiled private detectives. So when it came time to write a mystery novel, a crime novel of my own, my only thought was to play the central part myself. Because I was already out of my element. I didn't know what a private investigator did. I had to read up on police procedure and California criminal law and ballistics and toxicology. So I figured my only area of expertise was being female, and I better take advantage.
You started writing the Kinsey Millhone novels as a means, I read, to escape a successful career in TV writing, which is usually with the opposite of how it usually goes, where people who can't make money writing novels say, okay, I'm going to go into show business now. But you didn't like making a lot of money in Hollywood.
No. Well, I had done a stint in Hollywood because my second published novel, which is called The Lolly Madonna War, sold to Hollywood, and that was made into a film that came out in 1973. fabulous cast. It was Rod Steiger and Robert Ryan. And
the young Jeff Bridges, right?
Yes, indeed. It was really a wonderful cast. It was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot in Hollywood, but I am just not a team player. I do not like to write by committee, and I don't like help. So in Hollywood, if you're not interested in collaboration, you just have no business being there. And it took me a while to figure that out.
Whereas writing novels, you are in control. You're the screenwriter. You're the director. You're everything.
I know, which is good news and the bad. When the work is going well, there's nothing better. When I'm stuck, I wouldn't mind having a small committee at my feet to help me through the rough passages.
There has never been an American TV series or movie version of Kinsey Millhone. How come?
Oh, well, for the very reason I just detailed. I worked in Hollywood for 15 years, and I was guilty of adaptations, probably trashing the work of writers far better than I. I know what they can do. I know how destructive that system can be. For one thing, the first time that character is cast and an actress steps into that role, half my readers will be outraged, and I will also. Plus, they don't buy a book. They buy the rights to the character. And even in 1982, here's how those contracts read. They buy a character throughout the universe in perpetuity in technologies known and technologies yet to be invented. It's like, don't think so.
So you leave that money on the table knowing you're paying some financial price. But
it's no price at all. I tell you, my peace of mind and my good nature are worth quite a bit of money. I just don't want that system coming after me.
This new book, Kinsey and Me, has 9 stories about Kinsey and a dozen or so highly autobiographical stories that you wrote many years ago in your 20s.
Yes.
These non-Kinsey stories, these ones you wrote when you were practically a kid, what made you want to publish them now?
My husband did a limited printing of these stories, the whole collection, in 1991. Of late, with social media being what it is, I've got readers clamoring, and I know it's a bold word, of really pressing me to do additional publishing. And since this book was largely finished, I thought it might be a good idea to give it a commercial airing.
Well, I'd love to have you read an excerpt from one of those, the one whose title I'm forgetting right now, but about living as an adult in one's childhood home, in your childhood home in Louisville, I assume?
Yes, this story is called A Portable Life. The basement flooded in winter, water creeping up the basement stairs like a thief. Bats came down the chimneys and the walls. In certain sections of the house were solid brick a foot thick, so that the plumbing could never be improved. There would be occasions when my father would go up with a flashlight into the eaves of the house, and the air up there must have been 85 years old. The house was made up of oddities and improvisations. The laundry chute between the two bathrooms was boarded up, but a stale wind still blew up from the cabinet below. I would drop things into that darkness now and then, knowing there could never be a bottom to a pit like that, though there was, of course. One could run down to the basement and open the laundry bin to retrieve lost combs and doll shoes, old rags. When I was young, if I wet my pants, I would toss them down that chute, thinking that I would never be discovered in my sins. I hate to think, when the house was torn down, what the workmen discovered in a day's destruction. Messages I hid under loosened fireplace tiles in my bedroom. Old dreams boarded up in the walls. God, I'm glad I never saw that house torn down.
That is Sue Grafton reading from one of the stories in her new book of stories, Kinsey and Me, which is a lovely passage and makes for what I read, and you've said these early stories are highly autobiographical, essentially a personal essay. So I'm wondering why you made that fiction. Why not just, this is a personal essay about my home?
Well, I think recollection is a fiction in its own right.
Yeah.
We do not remember everything. We remember what suits us, or we remember what gives us pain. If you will notice, if you have an argument with somebody, you can remember all the amazing things you said, but there are silly points you quickly delete. So I think we edit without even meaning to.
This A is for, B is for, C is for thing was clearly a brilliant scheme to invent, to start out with 30 years ago. Have you regretted it ever along the way of, oh, my God, I got to get to Z?
In some respects, looking back, I think what nerve, what cheek I had at the age of late 30s when I started that book, thinking I could do 26 novels.
Yeah.
For one thing, I had not even sold A is for Alibi. I sold that book on the basis of 65 pages, never having written a mystery in my life. So I was flying by the seat of my pants. And when A was published, I had no guarantee that there would be a B is for Burglar, let alone C is for Corpse, D is for Deadbeat, and on down the line.
And how sad it would have been if you'd ended with E or F.
Exactly. I was happy to get through those letters. I was always waiting for them to say F is for failure. So I was really happy.
D is for done.
In fact, there was a review of B is for Burglar that said B is for boring. And I thought I would faint. However, I did survive that wicked comment.
And are you almost done with W?
Yes. I probably have, I would hope, fewer than 100 pages. I know where I'm going. I know what I need to do. And the question is, what is the exact order of events? What is the layering? What is the sequence in which information comes to her?
So of the 22 previous ones, by my count, 20 of them have been nouns and two of them have been adjectives, which are I is for innocent and L is for lawless. And I was thinking, what could W be? Maybe wicked, or maybe you just want to tell me.
I will not tell. For one thing, readers have so much fun trying to guess. And as a minute I shoot off my big mouth, somebody's going to be disappointed. But also, I have changed my mind on many occasions. When I thought K was for kidnap, so I blithely set off down that wrong path. And at a certain point, I realized that Kinsey Millhone is a small-time private eye. Kidnapping is a federal crime, and trust me, the FBI is never going to consult her. So I had to toss pages of notes, chapters of the book, and I came up with the title K is for Killer because I thought, well, that'll cover a multitude of sins. Doesn't matter what kind of storyline I come up with, it's bound to be applicable.
I really don't envy you having to come up with X and Z.
I know. X, see, I am hoping that by the time I write X, somebody will invent an entirely new crime. I hope it's going to be really good and juicy and nasty. And then I can just set out on that road.
Maybe. Well, there's some drugs, you know, Xanax or...
Yeah, Xanax, the killer Xanax.
So in you know, 3 years, you're going to be done. Do you have plans for post-Kinsey Millhone novels, or is that it?
It's going to be 8 years. It's been taking me 2 years per book. So when I get to X, I'll start that in 8 months after I get out of the institution they check me into for finishing this book, you know, after I get my meds adjusted. And I don't know what X is. I don't have a clue. I know even less about Y and Z, but surely something will occur to me between now and then. And after that, I will be close to 80 years old, and I personally think I should be allowed to take a long nap and then party.
There you go. So like Philip Roth, you're gonna call it quits at 80.
I don't think so, because I don't know what else I would do with my life. I agonize through these books, and I pray, it's like every day, please let me get to the end of this book. Then I get to the end of the book, and I have about 4 days of wild freedom. I can go to the grocery store, like at 10 in the morning. And after I do that for about 3 days, I think, this is so boring. You know, it's like life has no meaning and no purpose, so I have to come back to my machine.
So I guess it's like Dr. Johnson in London. When you're tired of writing, you're tired of life, and you're not tired of life yet.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Sue Grafton, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Sue Grafton's latest book, Kinsey and Me, is out right now. Not long ago, if you wanted to make it as a stand-up comedian, you had to get gigs headlining comedy clubs, appearances on late-night talk shows, and a Comedy Central or HBO special. But in the last few years, a surge in comedy podcasting has changed the way comics work.
We're beginning to realize our careers don't hinge on someone in a plush office deciding to aim a little luck in our direction. There are no more gates.
That is the comedian and actor Patton Oswalt speaking at a comedy festival in Montreal last year. Podcasting, Twitter, YouTube, Oswalt said that all of these tools have started to free comedians to reach audiences on their own in new ways. The traditional gatekeepers, TV executives and club owners, are mattering a little less these days.
Please, please throw the old model away.
But the question remains, as it does throughout the new digital world, how's anyone making money off this mostly free model? And is it actually changing comedy? Tom Dreisbach talked to some comics to try to find out.
Let me introduce you to Pete Holmes.
I'm 32 years old. I don't have any kids, but I'm already kind of like a fun dad.
That's from Pete's comedy album, Impregnated with Wonder.
Just that dorky dad at a barbecue, just like, hello. Ooh, Fresca, that guy.
Pete's goofy, high energy, and for about a decade, he worked at the comedy clubs, building that persona. But then he started a podcast. You made it weird. On You Made It Weird, he interviews other comedians. Nothing revolutionary there. But the podcast covers the intimate details of Pete's life, too. Religion, depression, and his divorce. Here's a bit from an episode.
My marriage, which ended, she was like, you don't need a wife, you need a nanny. That's what she said. It was a good line. It hurt, but I was also kind of like, well-crafted.
You can order. Go ahead.
I met up with Pete at a hot dog joint in D.C. after a recent stand-up show.
Doing the podcast changed everything, 100%.
About 40,000 people download the podcast, and they listen to Pete for up to 2.5 hours at a time. So when he performs now, his fans feel like they know him.
People come up to me after the show, and they're like, isn't it weird that I know how you lost your virginity? Or isn't it weird that I know your wife cheated on you? Or isn't it weird that I know whatever? I'm like, nope.
That night, when Pete wrapped up his set, audience members wanted hugs, not autographs. And the podcast has changed how Pete writes jokes. He can workshop material without the pressure to deliver punchlines.
The road to some wonderful, new, challenging, hopefully interesting bit is paved with no laughs. Zero laughs. In fact, the opposite of laughs. Awkwardness, fear, anxiety. But then at the end, there's this joke or this idea, this funny idea, that you never would have gotten at if you had the burden of an audience.
The podcast also changed Pete's business model. It's free to download, and his sponsors don't pay a whole lot. But Pete can sell way more tickets to live shows now. And there's something else that keeps Pete motivated.
I'm uploading my entire personality for public consumption, which sounds weird, but for somebody, for better or worse, who enjoys being seen and validated by strangers, it's a great feeling.
And comedians have figured out that a podcast doesn't have to be funny to be successful.
Lock the gate!
Take a guy like Marc Maron. He started doing stand-up in the late 80s, but by the late 2000s, his career was tanking. Now he runs one of the most popular podcasts out there. It's an interview show called WTF.
I am Marc Maron. This is WTF. I cannot thank you enough.
A lot of the time, he's not trying to be funny. He talked to Fiona Apple about her mental illness, and he asked Robin Williams about contemplating suicide.
You're sitting naked in a hotel room with a bottle of Jack Daniels? Yes. Is this maybe influencing your decision? Possibly. Okay, we're going to put that over here, possibly for therapy, or maybe a podcast 2 years from now. Do you want to talk about it in the podcast?
That raw, unedited emotion makes Marc Maron's podcast unique. And it's connected him with a wider audience, one that actually was not seeking live comedy.
You know, it's a tough bracket that we all got into. And, you know, you hit a certain juncture in your life and your career, and finding something that you can sort of put out there in the world exactly how you want to do it it's a rare and exciting thing.
I think a podcast is the ultimate social networking for a comedian right now, as we speak, and it's even getting bigger.
That's Robert Kelly. He's been doing stand-up since the early 90s, and he's got a podcast called You Know What, Dude?
You Know What, Dude?
That's it.
Do you know what? Dude podcast.
There you go.
We can't actually play much of his podcast on the radio. It's pretty filthy. But Robert told me how a successful podcast online can draw audiences in real life.
And now you're making way more money at clubs. You can make 20 grand a weekend at a club now. And then they can go buy you T-shirts from the show, and you're going to make, you know, an extra $20,000 a year on that. And now because your podcast is popular, some fan at a network is a fan, and then they want to give you a TV show. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going.
So I called up an executive.
This is Joanne Grigioni. I'm the vice president of talent and specials at Comedy Central.
So you are kind of the gatekeeper in comedy, huh?
One of them. No, nobody wants to be tasked with that responsibility of being the gatekeeper, I don't think, but sure.
Joanne says that podcasting has changed the comedy landscape in a couple ways. For one, today's audiences don't need a punchline every other minute.
It's funny because you would think that the internet sort of made attention spans shorter, but I think when they perform live, they could be a little bit looser on stage, and it seems like the audiences are kind of trained more to like a different pace.
And it helps her find fresh talent.
Some people have been excelling in that medium who, you know, maybe wouldn't have come to our attention in the way that they have without that medium.
Hi, I'm Tom.
Hi, Tom. I'm Nikki. Sarah's on her way over.
A couple years ago, Nikki Glaser was working as a club comic, but couldn't support herself. Sarah Schaefer was writing a blog for Jimmy Fallon. They both wanted a different kind of career. Then they met at a party.
The subject of podcast came up, as it often does in comedy circles. And she kind of, I remember her saying, you know, I've always wanted to start a podcast. And I was like, gosh, I would too. And then I think one of us jokingly, kind of maybe not jokingly, said, we should do one together. And the next week, I think we were recording.
Hey! Welcome to You Had to Be There.
You made it. You did it.
A lot of their podcast is improvised banter, silly conversations with comedians or writers they know.
I hate that Moves Like Jagger song so much.
It's so bad.
It feels like a prank, the fact that they're playing it over, like, it's just a big joke that we're supposed to...
It's performance art.
Ooh, that is the worst.
It's not exactly pushing the boundaries of the medium, but MTV caught notice of the podcast early on, and they liked it so much, they're producing a TV version. Nikki and Sarah Live premieres this week.
You're supposed to go through this system to kind of become a successful comedian, and what Nikki and I have done is proof that you can do it a different way.
But that different way still involved a network executive from Viacom. And Marc Maron, he's starring in a TV show based on his life. Pete Holmes has a cable show in development, too. So remember what Patton Oswalt said? That there are no more gates? That's not true. Even a successful podcaster like Robert Kelly will tell you there are still gates. It's the path to them that's changed. If Richard Pryor or, say, Lenny Bruce were alive today, would they each have podcasts?
No, because we have those guys today. We have Louis C.K. and Chris Rock. They don't have podcasts. You know what they have? Fame.
For Studio 360, I'm Tom Dreisbach. The joke's on you, Jack.
Nikki Glaser and Sarah Schaefer's new MTV show, Nikki and Sarah Live, debuts this Tuesday. And you can find all the podcasts that we just mentioned on our website, studio360.org. Still ahead on today's show, an awkward instrument wins over a reluctant musician.
The vibrations that I could feel and the resonance in the room as the sound kind of attached itself to the other instruments. It was akin to falling in love.
A guy gets serious with his tuba. That's in just a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. For decades, the only serious math museum was in New Hyde Park, Long Island, a town you probably never heard of. And then it closed in 2006, leaving no serious American math museum. And did we even need one to begin with? A guy named Glenn Whitney thinks so. Whitney is a former math professor turned hedge fund player, and he's just raised $23 million to bankroll a new one. The Museum of Math opened in New York City last month with the intention of making math vivid and interesting. We sent Studio 360's Henry Alford to find out if that's possible.
I'm not what you would call a math person. I don't balance my checkbook. I can't do my own taxes. And I've never known how long you can leave a garlic bagel in a bag of assorted bagels before the whole thing turns into a bag of garlic bagels. Math is supposed to bring order to the universe, but instead it just makes me really anxious. So I did my breathing exercises and went to New York City's new math museum. I was getting a tour from the directors, Glenn Whitney and Cindy Lawrence.
You're our target audience, because the math that you're scared about is not the math that's here.
Wait, there's more than one math?
The math that you don't like is one little area of math, whereas we're showing you a broad expanse. Math can be creative, it can be colorful, it can be engaging, it can be fun.
And do you guys see the museum's competition as being more like the medieval torture museum in Amsterdam, or do you see it more like a snake farm?
It's not our intent to teach seven-year-olds the calculus of variations. We're trying to change perceptions about mathematics. We just want them to think math is cool.
Well, we're actually walking around one of our centerpiece exhibits here as we go down the spiral staircase.
We stopped first at an exhibit called Tracks of Galileo, two adjustable metal tracks, each with a tiny car on it.
So over 300 years ago, Galileo asked the question, if I wanted to have a car ride on a track between one fixed point and another, what shape should that track be so that the car would take the least amount of time just under the influence of gravity?
Most of us tend to think of the fastest distance between two points must be a straight line. It is the shortest distance, but in this case, it's not the fastest distance.
So let's give it a whirl.
A three-year-old girl and her mother were looking at the exhibit.
Do you want to race me? I'll do one side and you do the other, and we'll see who wins. Yes? Okay, fun. What's your name?
Mirabelle.
Mirabelle. So I'm going to go for like a big loop-de-loo. Mirabelle is going for a big opening ramp and then a couple of gentle undulations. It's fairly classical, her approach. I'm not sensing a lot of out-of-the-box thinking. Oh, the mother is helping, though. Mirabelle has help.
Let's go. Let's meet this guy.
All right, everything in place?
Good luck, kid.
All right, here we go. Whoa! Alford for the win!
Oh, my God.
Alford for the win! No, my dear. I don't think you did.
Let's do it again.
You want to do it again?
Having bolstered my confidence at a three-year-old's expense, I felt relaxed enough to open up to Glenn.
So here's my big math problem in my daily life is that I buy a salmon fillet that's shaped like Massachusetts, and I've got to know where to cut it in half to get two even pieces. Once again, there's a theorem which says that any angle you put your knife at, if you slide it back and forth away from you, there's one location where we'll cut that piece of salmon into two identically sized pieces. Yeah, and so how do I find that spot, Glenn? Well, the theorem didn't say that there was a way to find it. It just said that it existed.
And there's a classic math answer for you. I always think that math is going to have solid answers for me because it's numbers. But then instead, when math gets all abstract, I'm trapped inside this mass of uncertainty and I can't get away or breathe. It's like a fart in a spacesuit.
If you want to look at Math Square, it's playing a new game now.
So here's a huge part of the floor downstairs called the Math Square. It's probably 12 feet by 12 feet. Please tell me this is the dance floor.
Well, you can dance on this floor, but you can also step onto it with us and let's see what happens.
Ooh. Night fever. Do-do-do-do-do. So a big pink spot lights up where you stand, and then a line draws to who's ever standing closest to you. It's sort of like Twister, but with artificial intelligence.
So it's actually like a jumbotron in the ground, and your feet are touching the touch screen. So it's recognizing you based on your feet. And what we're showing here is the shortest path to connect all of us that are standing on the square right now.
I wonder, as I'm sure many children will, what's going to happen when I get on all fours.
Glenn has done it already.
There goes Glenn. Glenn into the crab walk. Show us the crab. Oh, baby. I'm going to do it too. This is as much fun as I've had all week. This is very weird and fun. I think this game with the lights off and a little vodka, then you're talking.
Should we head to Human Tree?
We looked at an exhibit called Human Tree. A wall projected an image of you, and when you moved, it multiplied into tens of duplicate images or fractals.
Oh, look at that. That's beautiful. It looks like a kaleidoscope. What part of my ordinary life am I encountering fractals?
Well, we call it Human Tree. I mean, that's not a coincidence. If I took a very large tree and I cut off a huge branch and I stuck that branch straight down into the ground, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between that and the whole original tree. It wouldn't look exactly the same, but it would look like an ordinary tree to you.
Some days when I feel really bottled up, I feel like I'm one of those Russian Matryoshka dolls. Am I getting too personal here?
No, but that's exactly the same principle, right? We're repeating a similar structure on smaller and smaller scales. And that happens with the shape of a coastline. If you look on a large scale map, you see one curve. But as you zoom in closer and closer, you're constantly seeing new, smaller bays and islands and so on. The same type of structure is repeated on many, many scales. That's a theme that goes throughout nature. You see it occurring in the patterns in the stock market. It happens all over the place.
When I shimmy my hips, everything else ripples.
You got it. You're a natural mathematician.
For Studio 360, I'm Henry Alford.
I want to see that booty do math. Addition, subtraction, let me see them fractions. I want to see that booty do math. Won't you subdivide them, multiply and times them. I want to see that booty do math. I want to see that booty do, booty do. I want to see that booty do, booty do.
You can visit the Museum of Math 7 days a week in New York, and you can see pictures of the museum at our website, studio360.org.
I want to see that booty do math. Addition, subtraction, let me see them fractions.
We always like hearing from listeners, and every once in a while, one of you tells us a story we love about a work of art, some cultural artifact that changed your life. It's usually a movie or a song or a book or a painting or a TV show, but recently we heard from a listener whose existence was transformed by a musical instrument, a somewhat unlikely musical instrument.
My name is Steve Call. I live in Provo, Utah. First of all, I was a very poor student all the way through elementary school. At the end of each school year, my mother would go and beg the teacher to pass me on to the next grade because I never did learn to read in elementary school. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was dyslexic. That's why I was having all this trouble learning to read. But when I got into junior high school and started to learn to play a musical instrument, I figured out that I had a good ear and I could play lots of music without having to read any music. I started on an instrument called a trombonium that my uncle had in the basement. And I fortunately had a music teacher who recognized something in me in junior high school. He recognized I had a good enough ear that I could just play melodies just right out of my head through my instrument.
Well, I was accepted to Utah State University as a music major. I got a scholarship on the baritone horn. But when I got there, my teachers realized that I had a knack for playing other instruments, so I ended up playing the trombone at times, the French horn. I even played the bassoon and the bass clarinet. But I did feel that my aspirations in music were somewhat limited because I was such a poor reader. I really never dreamed that I could make a living as a professional musician. It just wasn't on my radar screen. So my senior year, the band director, Dr. Dalby, asked me if I would consider playing tuba in the band because they didn't have enough tuba players. And my view of the tuba was that it was the bottom of the musical food chain. The parts seemed kind of dull and repetitive, like, for instance, if you were playing a Sousa march or something, you'd just go 1-5, 1-5, 1-5, 1-5. And that didn't appeal to me very much. But I was being a good sport and giving it a go, yeah. The piece we started with was Verdi's overture to La Forza del Destino, The Force of Destiny. And it opens with some big unison notes in the low brass, punctuating sort of a sound of destiny. And I played those first notes. And the sound of the tuba as it blended with the trombones gave me a certain feeling that I guess the word would be visceral. The column of air that's vibrating within the instrument extends right down into my lungs. The tone color, it's like my voice coming through the instrument. The vibrations that I could feel and the resonance in the room as it the sound kind of attached itself to the other instruments. It was akin to falling in love. I have this heightened sense of awareness. I remember what the clock looked like on the wall, the smell of the room, the faces of the people around me. It's just very, very vivid. And the tuba part would just be pumping along, propelling the momentum from the bottom. And at that moment, I knew that I'd found my instrument. This is the instrument I was going to get serious about playing. But more it helped me understand musical texture and how all the parts fit together, an orchestration. I guess I was just born to play the tuba because I just picked the thing up and it just, things started to fall into place. And it gave me the confidence that I could actually become a professional musician with tuba as my major instrument. Now, 42 years later, I'm a professor of music at Brigham Young University. I also direct the BYU Jazz Legacy Dixieland Band. But to this day, I still really enjoy playing those old war horses. One of my favorite pieces is the Symphony Fantastique by Berlioz, scored for two tubas, and in the final movement, there's a very prominent section where the tubas just take over. You're good.
Steve Call is a professor of music at Brigham Young University. You can see a video of him playing his tuba with his Dixieland band at studio360.org. Has some piece of music or a painting or poem or whatever ever changed your life? Tell us about it on our website, and we might put you on the air. And that's it for this hour. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Ruth Samuelson.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Studio 360 Show, and you can follow me on Twitter at KB Anderson, that's Anderson with an E.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate. By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
30 years ago, a middle school class wrote Francis Ford Coppola and begged him to make a movie of their favorite book. And he did.
Just looking back at the petition, it's so cute. You know, it's 7th and 8th grade, girly handwriting with big hearts and flowers.
The legacy of S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.